Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday, October 8th.
Right.
Okay, 2017. This is actually the anniversary of a day that lives in infamy for some people.
What day is that?
It's 60 years ago.
Yeah.
Today, I guess it was the Brooklyn Dodgers. Announced.
Yeah,
they were leaving New York.
Yeah, to move to
for LA.
Yeah, okay, that sounds plausible to me.
60 years
must have been after the end of the
because
season.
Robert Moses wouldn't give them
The site they wanted to build a new ballpark.
Yeah,
right. They were stuck in Ebbets Field, which was a crummy ballpark. And later, Robert Moses gave the site to the Mets for their new Park Shea Stadium.
Okay,
so he made a mistake.
He made a mistake, but he did some other things right. We were talking about Robert Moses this weekend because we happened to go out to Jones Beach.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the beach, and guess what? It was freezing cold at the beach.
But it was 80 degrees here.
It was 80 degrees everywhere else in the tri-state area, but it was freezing to death. It was
the 30-mile-an-hour wind.
At the Jones Beach.
But the water wasn't that cold.
No, but it was rough.
It was quite rough, and yet some intrepid souls, not including your faithful reporters, went into the water.
Well, there was a big sign.
It said no
saying
swimming.
It's prohibited.
That wouldn't stop us.
Really?
Yeah, the waves stopped me.
You? Yeah. Officer of the court?
Right. Didn't stop me. It was the waves.
Okay.
But just before that, we had a big event on Thursday night in New York.
Yes, we actually, out of the blue, had a very nice adventure. Daniel, who never seems to do much at work, but troll the internet.
That's right.
Like many people.
Thanks for giving me up.
saw an ad for a fundraiser for the Classic Stage Company, of which we are fans, and we've gone to some productions there downtown.
But this was at 54 Below, Feinstein's 54 Below, which we always meant to go to.
Right, so we were curious, and it was titled An Evening with Terrence McNally and Friends.
And we were both familiar with the name Terrence McNally, knew he was a playwright, but we're much more familiar with Terrence McNally, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, first of all, the venue was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Feinstein's 54 Below,
right
under
Studio 54.
Right next to Studio 54, under the doorway is, I guess it's literally under.
Right,
and it's a beautiful sort of over the top, I would say, kind of
Rococo space.
Rococo? Okay. Gilded Age kind of.
Go with me on that, yes.
Yeah, lots of gold and red velvet.
Oh, yeah, and ornately carved ceiling, it's quite delightful.
Coffered ceiling,
you
to call it.
Yes.
And it was small.
Yes. And it was very.
Grand piano in the front.
Right. And
little
there
stage.
Were two musical performers, or three really, Maren Massey and Jason Danielli, who we've seen on Broadway.
And Cheetah Rivera.
And they were about as far from us in 54 Below as you are from me right now.
Right. Well, even Terrence McNally was sitting
Pretty much sitting next to us.
A yard away from
us.
That's
right. It was a very small venue. It was
So it's very,
very
exciting.
Informal.
It's very exciting that at the last minute.
It was intimate.
You got tickets to this.
Right.
And we go, and we have this terrific, they served hors d'oeuvres drinks. It was framed as a conversation.
With Terrence McNally.
With McNally, between McNally and the artistic director of CSC, John Doyle, who is a Tony Award winner for the revival, directing the revival of Color Purple, the most recent revival. And
it was a fascinating conversation.
It was a great conversation.
Yeah. And, you wouldn't necessarily assume, or I didn't assume, how super was going to be, and it was super. There were a couple of things. Well, why don't you give me your reaction? Because
I was just going to say, I mean, he was interesting, touching, provocative.
Right.
It was a great conversation. Yeah. Plenty of interesting people aren't interesting speakers.
Sure.
But this was great. Now, just to put his career in perspective, I have a list of some of his more well-known projects. Love, Valor, Compassion, Masterclass. He did the book for Ragtime, The Ritz, It's Only a Play, which was written in the 80s but was recently revived
on Broadway.
Nathan Lane and others. And The Rink. Also, This is kind of fun. Mothers and Sons.
We started at Bucks County Playhouse.
Premiered at the Bucks County Playhouse.
This is where we are.
You know, how
I surprised him with that,
yeah.
Didn't I? Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. That cuts across. He wrote for off-Broadway. He wrote Broadway plays. He wrote Broadway musicals. And he wrote a couple screenplays. And he wrote for opera.
Yeah, he did the libretti for...
Right. That's a lot of writing. That's a lot of variety.
One quote that was in the material I was reading from him was, he sees theater as a place to bridge rifts between people.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a nice way to look at art in general, I think, is something that does that.
Yeah, I mean, he was very casual. He's very offhanded.
78 years old.
78 years old.
And very articulate.
He talked about his experiences in New York coming up in the theater. He had been from Corpus Christi. New York was totally foreign to him. He got familiar with New York by going to plays when he was a student at Columbia, and he saw the greatest plays, the greatest musicals.
Well, his parents took him to plays growing up, too.
In Corpus Christi?
No, they occasionally came to New York.
Did they?
They were from New York originally.
Oh, see, I didn't catch that. Okay.
So it wasn't like he was from Mars.
Right, but he did talk at length about coming to New York and seeing The King and I, and seeing My Fair Lady, and seeing Damn Yankees, and he was getting in for $1 a shot in West Side Story.
Yeah.
$1 a shot. Well, particularly poignant, he saw West Side Story because you had there Cheetah Rivera, who was in the original cast of West Side Story.
Yes.
He was sitting right next to him.
So interspersed with the conversation were these performances by Jason Danielli.
And Maren Mazzie.
And Maren Mazzie,
and
who
Cheetah,
are married to each other, but they're great performers.
Right.
And they sang songs we weren't even familiar with.
Well, the funniest thing to me was they sang songs primarily from Ragtime. And Maren Mazzie was in Ragtime. And what was funny was she finished the song. It was very powerful, very affecting. And then John said, well, you know, we should mention that the writers of Ragtime, or I'm going to forget their names,
Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty.
Right, and they were the people sitting right to the
right
left
next
of us.
To us.
Right next to us. Oh, that couple, who seemed to be restrained in their applause. They wrote it. So there was that. They were modest, admirably modest. Anyway, it was a
And
fantastic.
Cheetah Rivera, yeah. 84 years old.
84 years old.
And her song was great.
Yeah, it was different. It was different.
I mean, it certainly was, you know, it was sung in a very low key, et cetera.
Right, she's not going to reach the heights.
It was not...
It was very effective.
It was very effective.
We can't cover it all here because he spoke for more than an hour. But he spoke about collaborating in the theater as much as anything else. He spoke about other writers like Sam Shepard and Edward Albee. He spoke about working with different cast members, how critical it was to set the play the right way. What the writer's role is, being the architect of what goes forward, how he strived to get people like Zoe Caldwell in master class, because that you need to have a certain footprint in order to keep going and make the play a great play. And he even talked about critics. He had a funny story about he almost ran over John Simon with a car, but he didn't.
Well, he was fantasizing.
He was fantasizing
about running over him.
And he did not chuckle or give an inch or get ironic about the critics. He doesn't like critics, so he's entitled. So in any event, that was
out of
fantastic.
Nowhere. That was
it was a fantastic evening.
And just because you were trolling the internet.
That's right. And also because we're near New York City. That's the other key
part
of it.
Yes.
All right. So baseball. I know we don't talk enough about baseball. Let me see what I can remedy that very quickly. Now, I know we talk a lot about baseball. There was an interesting article. It was statistically oriented.
My favorite things. Yes. Math and baseball.
Well, I'm going to come back to that theme. About what's ailing baseball, or is it baseball ailing? Are the games really slower? Are they really longer? Is it all in our mind's eye?
They're really, really long.
They're really, really long. And they give us an example of this. They say the first game of last year's World Series between the Indians and the Cubs took 3 hours and 37 minutes. There were 41 mm-hmm. balls in play over 3 hours, 37 minutes. The first game of the 1970s.
What does that mean, 41 balls in play?
Ground balls, fly balls, whatever. Anything but a strikeout or home run. Fielders get to do something. Action, right? In the 1976 World Series, some time ago, the first game of the World Series, as opposed to 3 hours, 36 minutes, 2 hours, 10 minutes.
When was this?
1976.
1976?
2 hours, 10 minutes.
That was just yesterday.
52 balls in play. I mean, think about this.
A lot more action in a much shorter time.
An hour and 20 minutes shorter, more action, compared to today's baseball. 1970s baseball was highlight, right? That's how much baseball has changed. And that's the problem. And they do break down statistically why that is. It's more pitchers each game. It used to be four pitchers a game with the two teams. Now it's eight pitchers a game. More home runs. We all know more strikeouts. More stats, more fancy defenses, more visits to the mound, more strategizing, longer and longer periods between play. The average age, this is the thing that's got to be most alarming, the median age of a baseball fan in North America is, do you want to guess that number?
No.
57.
All right.
57.
Is that good or bad?
It's horrible.
It's horrible?
If you're running baseball and the average age is 57, it's you got a problem. They got to do something about that. But what's funny to me also is there's statistics on the one hand, and there's old line baseball guys on the other, and they each have their own issues. So you can run things by the numbers, and you get these some very young managers who hardly play the game, but most of the managers are old line about a lot of things, and they run it the way the managers did 40, 60, 80 years ago when it comes to handling personnel. That they don't give up.
And is that good or bad?
It can be bad. So when you deal with the Yankees, who are now down 2-0 in the series, we'll see how that plays out. I mean, you have a situation there. It's a typical old-line manager thing. That's Joe Girardi. Joe Girardi has relief pitchers who he realizes are hot this month, are doing better this month, right? Tommy Kanye, Green, others, of course, the closer. And as opposed to Devin Betances, who's really been off. So he's not pitching Betances. And they get into a series, which is a short series, and even when they're winning, well, actually, they first had a one-game series with Minnesota, even with a big lead, would not put Betances in because he's too conservative, and he works the other guys, including David Robertson. And then it comes to the next game, and that's a close game, and the following game, extra innings, still not Betances. And finally, only when he runs out of pitchers, does he put in Betances.
So he's overworking some guys.
First, he overworks the guys, and that results in him giving up an 8-3 lead. 8-3 becomes 8-8. If he put Betances in earlier, it would have been okay. And then when he gets through extra innings, Betances is a great inning. Betances is a great second inning. They ask 3 innings. The guys in pitch for a long time. They lose the game. But you have to manage saying, I got 25 guys. I got to use all 25 guys. I got to live or die with 25 guys.
But if he's nervous because the guy hasn't been doing well.
Right. You got to take the long view. You got to say, I got to take a chance.
I got to get him back in.
It only works. It right. only works if we get them all involved, as opposed to, as I like to say in the game, dance with the guy that brung you. That's not a strategy. That's it's a dancing approach. So anyway, the Yankees may be paying for that. But you had something about new developments in travel.
New developments.
Right. There you go.
It's just that they're... was a very nice picture of a train interior in the business section of the Wall Street Journal. And it's in Japan. And Japan train lines are promoting, to some extent, these luxury cars and luxury tours that can cost up to $22,000 for a tour. And they have these really terrific appointments. Right. They're like gold-plated bathrooms.
It looks like a great living room.
Musicians playing German stained glass, they're trying to appeal to an older rider who has
who's interested in baseball.
Who knows if they're interested in baseball? But part of the idea here is not that they're going to make $1 zillion doing this, so much as it's a kind of a marketing thing and gives them exposure and creates interest.
Yeah, I did notice this.
It was poignant to me because remember I read that book, Inheritance from Mother, by Mine Mitsumura, and a train, a very sort of nostalgic, evocative train ride figures quite importantly in that book. So, again, this resonated with me, beautiful rides in trains in Japan.
There's something about the age of train travel. I mean, there's something that's different. It won't get you there as quickly, but it can be an experience.
Well, I know my younger brother Bryce and Lorna, his wife, and a group just took a train from South Carolina
to New Orleans.
How'd that work out? It was a 13-hour ride.
Were they still talking at the end of it?
Yes, I think they are. Right. But, you know, part of the reason they went by train so they could experience that. And then they flew back.
Of course. Because they couldn't get home.
13 hours is one thing, but 26 hours, that's a big investment.
All right. Well, all right. So here's a serious story, which has kind of caught both of us kind of flat-footed. And it started when we were reading an obituary of a fellow named John Thompson. John Thompson was a person who was imprisoned in Louisiana for 14 years on death row for having committed murder. And after a bunch of appeals with varied success and coming very close to being executed several times, after 14 years, new evidence was discovered, and he was exonerated and set free. And he had 14 more years before he passed away. But it is a very strange story, because it turns out that what happened was he was convicted because the DA's office acted improperly, extremely improperly. They hid evidence that would have set him free. In particular, there was a microfiche of a blood report, which showed that it wasn't his blood on the victim, as was assumed. And that did not come to light. And the DA's office knew about it and hid it and didn't bring it to light. And it only came to light after a deathbed confession from one of the assistant DAs, a fellow who happened to have a disease, said, "I can't live with this. I have to tell people to go look for this microfiche."
On his deathbed.
On his deathbed. And that's what freed him.
Right.
All right? And so
that's interesting.
That's crazy. So then they try him again, believe it or not, in New Orleans. He's acquitted in 35 minutes. All right?
Thank God.
And here's the crazy thing. The DA's office in New Orleans at that time is run by Harry Connick.
Harry Connick. Okay. Harry Connick Sr.
Harry Connick Sr. As some of us are aware, it's always been sort of a fun fact that Harry Connick Jr.'s father was the district attorney for many years in New Orleans. Harry Connick Sr.
Well, that's pretty shocking.
Right.
Because you imagine that Harry Connick, I mean, you look at Harry Connick Jr.
Right.
And he seems like, you know, all-American, fine, upstanding boy. Wow.
Right. So then, the story's not over. So Thompson sues, I mean, he's got lawyers by this time, right? He sues the New Orleans office for, you know, illegal prosecution and abuse of their discretion. And the theory is that the office is run in such a way, it's not that it's a singular isolated mistake, that it's run in such a way that it tramples over the rights of indigent defendants.
Deliberately.
Well, either recklessly. Use recklessly. That's all the only standard they have to get. And it goes, and he wins. The lawsuit for $14 million. Thompson wins, but it gets appealed to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Right? And the Supreme Court reverses it 5-4. Reverses it 5-4 so that he doesn't get a nickel. And Justice Thomas, who's the fifth vote, the majority vote, says, "Look, I understand what happened here was awful, but we don't see enough evidence for a pattern of conduct such that you could charge Harry Connick Sr. with this kind of reckless indifference." Having said that, Harry Connick Sr. lost his election to succeed to the next term at the DA. The new DA was quite relieved not to be facing this award. Thompson, on his part, said, "Look, I'm so far beyond looking for money at this point.
Yeah.
I don't care about the money. But it is odd to me that, you know, if I had spilled hot coffee on me, I could have sued somebody for $1 million. But here, the DA's office purposely hides evidence and puts me in jail for 14 years, and I don't have a lawsuit? Is that possible?" It's a crazy story, but what really puts a point on it is it's Harry Connick Sr. And as a result, he ended his term as a very controversial figure. The Times, an op-ed piece, dismissively refers to his term as DA as somewhat racist. I did some research to get some of the details here.
Wow.
But the Times just says, that awful term of Harry Connick Sr., who, by the way, succeeded Jim Garrison at New Orleans. You remember, he was involved in the JFK investigation. Played by Kevin Costner in the movie. But so that's kind of a notorious spot. Anyway, shocking story.
Self-control. Well, it's not like I'm a poster child for self-control. So when I'm reading the kind of health and science section of the right. Times, and there's an article saying exercise may increase self-control.
Right.
Okay, so that's a little upsetting because I exercise a lot.
That's right.
So I should have supreme self-control. I don't know about that. It says here, a new study suggests that exercise may be a simple, if unexpected, way to increase our willpower and perhaps make us avoid making impulsive choices we will later regret.
Right.
And so there's a story of rather a small study that was done.
Right.
That involved people thinking they were training to be in a 5K.
Right.
And they met periodically, and they filled out questionnaires about that had questions, including ones about delayed gratification. Like, would you take $5 today or wait a week and get $15?
Right.
Okay. And what the survey showed,
right.
or what the study showed, was that those who participated in the meetings and did the workouts seemed to dramatically improve in their ability to prefer that delayed gratification.
Yeah.
And those who fell off the wagon, those who didn't, but still filled out the forms in the end, did not.
Right, they won the $5 today. And it was almost granular, because the people who did mediocre, you know, were looking for $7.50 today. You know, they were kind of in between on those kind of questions. So it looked like there was almost a direct relationship, but it's a very thin study.
But it also looked like if you did anything at all, you improved.
You improved, to be sure.
If you did any kind of exercise at all, you improved.
Right.
So that, you know, they're concluding that exercise alters the working of portions of the brain involved in higher level thinking and decision making, which may in turn play important roles in impulse control. Okay? I think that's interesting because what it means is changing the way the brain works, not just, you know, I've done a good thing, I've worked out, so I can make better decisions. The brain is actually changing the way.
It could be. They'd have to do more work to see, but it doesn't shock me.
This goes back to another recent article about, you know, how to improve your health dramatically and how to improve your chances for a long, healthy life dramatically. And the number one thing is
exercise. Yeah.
Always.
Always. Okay, so there was an interesting article in New York Magazine about screenwriters. They have a quote from Alfred Hitchcock. And here's the quote. Hitchcock said, to make a good film, you need three things. The script, and the script. So obviously there's a man who believed in screenwriters.
So this is, they're doing a list of the 100 top screenwriters.
That's what they set out to do, and that's
what
they
did. So there are like more than 100 screenwriters?
Yes. So there are. Yes, Tamsin.
There are a lot of them.
This is over time. It's over history. But
history.
The way they did it was they said, look, you know, there are questions. What is the essence of the screenwriter's art? Is it plot? Is it dialogue? Is it character? Is it all that and more? Well, they didn't answer that question directly, but they did poll 40 very prominent current screenwriters, and they said over the history of movies, who are the best screenwriters?
Do you revere?
And in the poll. And, you know, since they were all modern screenwriters being polled, as you'd expect, the names that are most prominent on the list that rank the highest, almost without exception, are current screenwriters. Just to give you an idea, the Coen brothers, Quentin Tarantino, Francis Ford Coppola, Woody Allen, Oliver Stone, Aaron Sorkin, Spike Lee, George Lucas, you get the idea. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of folks who were on that list who are modern too, who might surprise you. You might not know the name, but they wrote pretty varied movies. William Goldman wrote The Princess Bride, but also wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men. I mean, it's kind of an interesting list, but it's very slanted toward modern screenwriters, except for one. The number one person on the list is, surprisingly, Billy Wilder.
Hmm.
And the number one script that they talk about is Billy Wilder's The Apartment.
Really?
The Apartment is the movie on which Promises, Promises is based. And it was a movie in 1960.
Right.
That starred Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story about two young people who are trying to get ahead in the world, which they don't have much of a place. Lemmon's letting his apartment be used for assignations by executives. Shirley MacLaine's...
Superiors in his company? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Fred McMurray. And Shirley MacLaine is one of a young woman involved in those assignations. And naturally, they fall for each other. And what the movie's about is how they manage to get up the nerve to try to set things right, to unravel what's going on, to put themselves on a different path, even at great risk of financial success of their position.
So why does the screenwriter?
Well, that's the question. So
writing makes such a difference.
That's exactly the question. And let me go back to something that Terrence McNally said, okay? Because Terrence McNally did screenwriting and did all kinds of writing, okay? Terrence McNally, several times during that presentation, Terrence mm-hmm. McNally said, the best writing I've ever seen
mm-hmm.
was in The King and I, in that scene where the two of them are together, the king and Anna are together, and they have the scene, Shall We Dance?
Right.
And he says, and there's not a moment of dialogue. Well, in fact, there is a moment of dialogue. He was exaggerating, but I'll tell you what the moment is. And this is illustrative. They're dancing at arm's length. Their arms are both extended. And she's just showing him how to dance. And you have the music in the background, Shall We Dance? Bah, bah, bah. And they're sort of dancing. They're going well. And Yul Brynner, the king, suddenly stops and says, no, something wrong. And she goes, what's that? And he goes, I watch Europeans dance. Not like this. And then he pulls her close and he puts his arm around her and he says, like this. And then, bump, 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 bump. And then they go start dancing. And that's the moment that he's talking about. It's one line, like this. And you go back to the Billy Wilder movie, The Apartment, and there's no great dialogue in it mm-hmm. that you can mm-hmm. say this is a line from The Godfather or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's the behavior of the characters. And I do remember the one line I remember is typical of the way that thing is written. At the very end, after they've upended everything and they don't know what they're going to do, they're sitting in her apartment. They're playing gin rummy and she's shuffling the cards. And Jack Lemmon can't contain himself. He's babbling about, oh, what just happened? There's this. We've got to do this and this. We're going to do this and this. He's just babbling. And she just has a half smile. She hands him the deck and she says, shut up and deal. And that's how that movie ends. So, I mean, there's more to it than writing. There's more to it than quotes. Anyway, if you get a chance, it's on vulture.com. 100 best screenwriters of all time. We had a couple books to talk about.
Yeah, a couple books. Yeah. I didn't see that much that was rocking my world in the book reviews this week.
Right.
But there was a mention of The Book of Cheese by Liz Thorpe and in the Wall Street Journal. And they did quote her recipe, the only cheese you should make at home, she said. And she had a recipe for ricotta, which is just milk, a little salt, a little white vinegar. And she says it's unbelievable.
It's good?
Yes, it's exquisite.
It's shocking because it looks like something that a human being couldn't possibly make.
You can. So maybe I should try that.
Is this something I can look forward to seeing in the refrigerator?
Perhaps, yes. Okay. I don't know that I'm going to buy the book because I don't need encouragement to like any more cheeses.
No, but you haven't been making enough cheese.
No, I have not.
That's what we have to do. Well,
I leave it to Bobolink.
Bobolink's a great place.
Bobolink. To make the cheese.
Those are the cheesemakers. There's no question. Cheesemakers are the king.
Artisanal cheesemakers.
There was a book making the rounds about Muhammad Ali called Ali, A Life by Jonathan Eich. And there was a review in the Wall Street Journal, and we saw a piece on the television today. And there's
interview on Fresh Air.
Right. And so-called revelations about Muhammad Ali. He was really...
And you take exception.
Because you said... The whole tone of it is
I'm telling you all these fabulous things I find out about Ali by listening to these interviews.
And I'm saying...
And you keep saying, everybody knows that.
Everybody knows
it's
that.
It's not new.
Well, look, here's the thing.
I think you're on a different planet.
You're on a different Ali
planet.
No. Well, first of all, I'm old. But besides that, they're saying, Ali, he was nervous. People didn't know he was quite anxious. At the time, if you were watching fighting at the time, he almost was not allowed to fight Liston because his heartbeat was too high during the medical exam. This was
There's a medical exam like right before
yes,
the...
Yes, yes. This is common knowledge. It's not a big deal. Then there was the notion of, people don't realize how beat up Ali got and it affected his speech. His whole strategy was getting beat up. That was the rope-a-dope strategy with George Foreman. It came at tremendous personal cost. Everyone was on to that. The idea that an older fighter managed, you know, his speech was slurred later in his career, unfortunately, that's kind of common experience. You get hit in the head a lot, that happens. And then it's the notion of Ali fought a long time, even, you know, beyond his peak, must have been for the money. No kidding. I mean, Ali, what his misfortune in the long term was, he had the opportunity to fight late into his 30s because his name was so big. But he fought 5 years beyond where he should have retired. And he got hit hard during those 5 years, and it hurt him. Hey, look, Ali.
But one of the big points in the interviews I heard was more about how when he died, I mean, there were presidents at his funeral, and yet at one time he had been the most hated man in America.
Right.
So it's that disconnect between, you know, becoming such a hero.
I understand that. And look, that tells us more about America and how tastes change and how political winds blow one way or the other, in this case about the Vietnam War. But what Ali was, I mean, Ali got out as a conscientious objector. He wasn't a conscientious objector. He didn't qualify as a conscientious objector. He got out on a legal technicality. He said, I have no beef with the Viet Cong. That doesn't make you a conscientious objector, especially if you're a prize fighter. You're not a pacifist. So things kind of worked out for him. But here's my point about Ali. I liked Ali.
Mm-hmm.
I still hold a high opinion of Ali. Ali was a great fighter and an extremely bright man. And to me, that's plenty. But to sort of put all this other stuff on him, as whether he's some mystical figure, some magical transcendent figure with religious overtones, there's nothing to that. But it's a lot to Ali, in my mind.
You're not going to read the book.
No.
You already know.
No. You had some theater you wanted to talk about.
Yes. Scrolling through what's going on around the globe in theater, there were a couple reviews of productions in the Boston area, one of which is called Warhol Capote, and it's actually a conversation, the dramatization of a conversation between Truman Capote and Andy Warhol, and it's based on, written by Rob Roth, and it's based on about 80 hours. It's taken from about 80 hours of conversations between, actual conversations between the two of them, recorded by Andy Warhol. And it doesn't get a stellar review, but it's it does sort of address a lot of aspects of celebrity, etc. You know, people may find it interesting or compelling. But the production that does get a stellar review is actually a new production of Merrily We Roll Along.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And this is actually directed by Maria Friedman.
Right.
Who is a British actress.
Right.
Largely an actress. And famous for, or known for, her interpretations of Sondheim.
Famous for. I mean, some of those productions were originally in London.
Yeah. And this production that's now at the Huntington Theatre Company in Boston, actually sort of originated in London itself, at the Meunier Chocolate Factory a few years ago. He has a couple of interesting little quotes about it. He refers to Maria Friedman's splendid London-born revival, this portrait of the slippery road to success in mid-20th century Manhattan has never seemed more emotionally resonant or gratifyingly fulfilled. And the pain that courses through Ms. Friedman's Merrily We Roll Along is authentic enough to keep its audience bathed in tears. And he, you know, this reviewer highly praises the performances of the cast, making this transcendent.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a couple of productions that came from London. That were greater.
Yeah. But also, we've seen recently saw a revival just a few years ago.
A Merrily We Roll Along.
It was transcendent.
Right.
And it was a flop when it was on Broadway, which I think we've talked about before.
Right.
So it'll be interesting if this trickles down from Boston to Broadway.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, I think it would be great. You remember we saw a production of Sunday in the Park with George that came from London a few years ago, going back to Carousel years ago. That was a London production.
So there must be something too, having those Brits kind of look at the Americans.
They look at it differently. They strip it down and they apply a different perspective to it,
yeah.
And they come up with something different.
Yeah.
Okay, so just a couple of quick hits to close, but I can't help but note a couple of things. One is that our car guy, Dan Neal, has a review of a Mercedes AMG GTR sports car. I'll read you just one line, which sums it up. He describes this as a bewinged phallus of an automobile. So there you go. So that tells you all you need to know about that car, and it goes on from there. We have Kazuo Ishiguro, who, of course, won the Nobel Prize for Literature, is an interesting guy, born in Japan, raised in England, and wrote The Remains of the Day, wrote Never Let Me Go. Serious artist, to be sure, but the greatest quote, the fun quote I saw, was when he was interviewed after he got the Nobel Prize. He was told that morning, he opens his door, there are all these reporters outside of his door, and the first thing he says, if I knew I was going to win the Nobel Prize, I would have washed my hair. Which is about as down-to-earth as it gets. And the final story is just a favorite of mine, and I feel I found my doppelganger here, sort of somebody who I have to link up with in some way, and it is Daryl Morey, who is a general manager of the Houston Rockets basketball team. Now, that's a very successful basketball team. And this year, they're going to compete for the championship in the NBA. They've got two great players, and they're right there. They're right on the cusp, and you'll be hearing a lot more about them. But, and he is one of these guys who is not a basketball player. He's a math guy. So he's always been a stat head, and he got the job purely because of his quantitative abilities, and he was analyzing X, analyzing Y, and suddenly he was an assistant coach for the Celtics, and then he was surprised higher as the general manager, and he's had fantastic success. But he reveals in this article that someday he wants to live in New York and just go to shows. He is over the top about Broadway shows, right?
An athlete and you know,
right. And here's
a lover of the theater.
Let me explain how extreme this is. Number one, now this is a guy with money, okay? He has, they say his appreciation for Stephen Sondheim runs so deep that he recently paid an artist to recreate a Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jatte, if I have that right, the seminal work by the painter George Seurat that became the focus of Sunday in the Park with George,
the
right?
Inspiration for the story, yeah.
Okay. Whenever he goes to New York, he finds time for a show. Quote from Morey, "I didn't think the worlds of the theater and basketball intersected. I thought the Venn diagram would be one person, me, the only person interested in basketball and Broadway shows. As it turns out, there are a few of us." So I'm saying, wow, this is my guy.
That intersection, right, that Venn diagram.
Right, but here's what clinched it. It's almost too much. He says, and this is the best part to me. When he goes to Broadway show, the zillionaire, Daryl Morey, he says, you know, you can walk up 15 minutes beforehand and ask for a deal on a single ticket, he said. No one else is lame enough to do this, but I'm lame enough. This is my guy. On top of everything, he's prudent.
He's prudent.
All right? So
some call it lame, some call it prudent.
That's right, lame enough. Right. So Daryl Morey. Oh, by the way, he is producing a show. That's what this is about. He doesn't just go to show. And it sounds like the worst
Nothing
show.
Nothing is accidental.
It is, believe it or not, it's a story about a team from the town of Lilliput in Gulliver's Travels, where all basketball players are super short. They get a player to play with them who's named Michael Jordan, but he's not the real Michael Jordan, and they're further challenged by the fact that in Lilliput there is no concept of the number 5, so that they can never get the appropriate number of players on the floor.
All right. That may be a leap, so, but I will keep my eyes peeled for that one.
All right, everyone watch out for that, and that's all we have this week.
That's all from Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. See you next week.
Thanks.